Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, February 18th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman Aaron.
So today on the show, the Trump administration will no longer regulate greenhouse gases. The announcement comes after the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, revoked the endangerment finding. What is that, you ask? Well, it was the Obama-era scientific finding that greenhouse gas emissions can be a danger to human health, and that finding provided the legal justification for federal climate rules on cars, trucks, and power plants that have been in place for more than a decade. So the White House and the EPA, they say ending greenhouse gas regulations will save taxpayers more than $1 trillion and make vehicles more affordable. Climate scientists and legal experts have been sounding the alarm. They warn that this type of deregulation could increase emissions, undermine public health protections, and create courtroom fights. So today we're going to pull back the curtain. We're going to take a deep dive look at the rollback of these climate regulations by the Trump administration. What does it actually change? What's still enforceable? Who will pay the price? And we'll break it down with a knowledgeable panel. We have a climate reporter who's been covering these issues, and we have lawyers who have differing viewpoints on environmental law who will kind of hash it out in the second half of the show. And we want to hear from you. What's your reaction to President Trump's push for climate deregulation? Do you have concerns? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, hello, put your comments in the chat.
888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org with your reactions. Also, if you just have questions about what this means, we've got experts here to answer those questions, 888-477-9499. But first, a trio of local news stories starting over the bridge in Camden. Mm-hmm. The Diocese of Camden announced yesterday it has reached a settlement with over 300 victims of sexual abuse and will pay those victims a combined $180 million. Now, this settlement still needs to be approved by a federal bankruptcy judge, but if it is finalized, it would be one of the largest sex abuse settlements involving the Catholic Church, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer. Survivors have been fighting this fight for a long time, but two relatively recent events helped turn the tide. First, in 2020, New Jersey expanded the statute of limitations for sex abuse claims, which led to a flood of new charges and claims. Second, the Diocese of Camden got a new bishop last year. That bishop has been more open to working with the state on its investigations and with survivors on a resolution, which leads to this momentous announcement yesterday by the Diocese of Camden.
Yeah, it's unclear at this point how much individual survivors will receive, but this is a pretty big deal. I mean, I think the Buffalo Archdiocese there, they reached a $150 million settlement for survivors last year. But this is just, you know, one step towards healing and accountability with the Catholic Church. You know, this has been going on for decades, and people feel some kind of way. They want the church to acknowledge the breach of trust that has happened with so many people dealing with this. And so many of the survivors, they need long-term therapy and stability, and this money will help them. And so we'll see. Hopefully the court will approve this. I understand that the committee of people that represent survivors has approved it. The insurers have approved it. The church has approved it. So we need the judge to sort of step in here, but long time coming.
Yeah. And by the way, it's before a judge because the Diocese of Camden is in bankruptcy.
Yeah.
So that's how the judge gets involved here. But that's the final step, as Cherry said, toward approving this historic settlement between the Diocese of Camden and victims of sexual abuse.
Yes. Story number two, you probably heard it was all over the news yesterday. Civil rights icon Jesse Jackson died on Tuesday. Tributes have been pouring in, including from Philadelphia leaders. The governor actually of Pennsylvania tweeted about his death, as well as many others. Former city council member W. Wilson Good Jr., son of Wilson Good, Philadelphia's first black mayor, said Jesse Jackson will be remembered in Philadelphia as a civil rights hero and a leader in terms of independent Black politics nationwide. The Philadelphia Inquirer did a nice roundup of Jackson's connections to the city of Philadelphia dating back to the 1970s. If you didn't know, Jesse Jackson was a protege of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and he was there the day he was assassinated, and he went on to run for president twice, first in 1984 and again in 88, and he came within striking distance of the Democratic nomination, but he came to Philadelphia repeatedly campaigning on his own, but also he was a figure who would rally Philadelphia's Black voters. But he had a fairly complicated relationship with Philadelphia's Black politicians.
Do say.
Yeah. According to Philly Voice, he campaigned for Wilson Good in 1983, but due to a misquote by a journalist, he ended up giving Rizzo fuel to attack Good during
that
game.
His opponent,
Frank Rizzo. But you know, obviously Wilson Good won in 1984. He also caused a bit of a dust up in 1985 when he visited Philadelphia after the MOVE bombing, and he called for a congressional investigation. He didn't name or criticize Wilson Good, the mayor at the time, but according to the Inquirer, it did complicate their relationship. Of course, he had other instances where he came to Philadelphia. I actually covered the Joe Frazier funeral in 2011. Jesse Jackson was there. Mm. He came in 2016 for the DNC. He was also here during the Occupy Wall Street protests
right
outside of City Hall. So he has used his influence in Philadelphia over the years.
For people that didn't know, Wilson Good was the first Black mayor of Philadelphia and part of that first generation of Black mayors all across the country in major cities. So, you know, the back and forth between the two of them is significant, historically significant for that particular reason. Also, while we're on this subject, I just want to shout out one more person who died this week, the documentarian Frederick Wiseman, mm-hmm. who was a pioneer in documentary filmmaking. And one of his first documentaries was a 1968 film called High School, which showed life inside Northeast Philadelphia High School. So if you ever want to check out that footage, it's really interesting stuff. Shows the culture clash happening in 1968. He also died this week.
A lot of long hair back in there.
Well, among the students and not the teachers, which is very obvious in the footage. But another person who passed away this week with a real connection to our city. So I wanted to note that.
Rest in peace.
All right. Story number three. Mm-hmm. We're going to go below high school for this one.
Uh-oh.
There is a report out of Venezuela that the Philadelphia Phillies have reached a pre-agreement with an 11-year-old shortstop that is worth $1.8 million. I'm not exactly sure what the words that just came out of my mouth
11
mean,
years old.
But they sound insane. This news was reported by a reporter in down there named Wilbur Sanchez. The player's name is David Basabe. Sanchez says he is the youngest player ever to sign a pre-agreement with a Major League Baseball club. So background here is that international players cannot actually sign with major league teams until they're 16. There are these weird, shady kind of pre-agreements that are like handshakes. They're not legally binding. And I will say the sourcing for this story is a little thin, but the Phillies have been reported to engage in these types of deals in the past with players below 16, trying to kind of get them into the pipeline for development. And in general, the competition for prospects in places like Venezuela and the Dominican Republic is incredibly fierce. We've never heard of it going down to the age of 11 years old, but it might be a sign of the times.
So interesting. All I can say is wow, because I'm thinking
11
years
old. That's all you can say?
11 years old is like fifth or sixth grade,
yes,
right?
It's quite young.
And a lot can happen between age 11 and 16 or 18, right? So to me, this is a very expensive bet.
So just to be clear, they're not really committing at $1.8 million.
I know.
When he turns 16, if he pans out, they might commit $1.8 million.
And it could be life changing for this family, right?
But
it's so interesting because according to ESPN, the MLB teams actively do these handshakes / verbal agreements internationally because they're really not regulated. And apparently a lot of kids lie about their age.
It's the wild west of sports development.
And they had one situation where a 19-year-old actually committed, lied, said they were 14.
Yeah.
But then once you get caught, you have to wait a year before you can actually try out. It's just a whole hot mess. Not being regulated. It's very shady.
It's obviously the power dynamics are what they are. You have these very wealthy clubs based in the United States and Canada, recruiting in often very impoverished neighborhoods in much poorer countries with a lot at stake, as you can imagine, and all sorts of shady stuff goes on. We don't know what's going on in this particular case with this particular prospect, but I will say the Phillies, like basically every team, have academies set up in these countries where players come in at very young ages and they basically do all their schooling and all their training at an academy run by the team.
Like it's wild.
It's wild. And frankly, it's kind of how the sausage is made in terms of player development internationally for baseball players. And, you know, different sports is totally different. But in baseball, this system exists and has existed for many decades.
Yeah.
But this particular one was like a little bit like, whoa.
It was whoa.
Even in that context. Also, whoa, climate policy changing.
The transition,
not great. But we're going to talk about it. Yeah. Other side of the break.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Last week, the Trump administration announced it would revoke the endangerment finding, an Obama-era ruling that required the Environmental Protection Agency to regulate greenhouse gases because of the threat to human health. The decision is in line with President Trump's previous comments. Here he was in September during his address to the United Nations.
It's the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world, in my opinion. I've been right about everything. And I'm telling you that if you don't get away from the green energy scam, your country is going to fail.
The White House says the regulatory rollbacks will make cars more affordable and save Americans over $1 trillion. But climate scientists are alarmed, considering that transportation is the number one source of greenhouse gases in the United States. To unpack the possible consequences of this latest regulatory rollback, we're joined by Zara Hirji, an environmental reporter at Bloomberg. Zara, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, and to you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere, we want to hear from you. Our question of the day is, what's your reaction to President Trump's push for climate deregulation? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, keep those comments coming in the live chat.
All right, let's start, Zara, by going back to 2009, the endangerment finding. What did it say and what did it do?
Yeah, so it's important to remember that the Obama EPA didn't just do this. They were doing this in response to a directive from the Supreme Court, which said that they had to look into this. And so they did this scientific finding and ultimately decided that based on all the scientific evidence, climate change poses a harm to human health. And because they decided that it was a harm, they then had to make mandates. And so the first ones that they did were climate mandates for cars and trucks.
And those climate mandates, what did they look like?
Well, they had to do with kind of requiring that vehicles or vehicle manufacturers take into account the emissions that are released from vehicles, which hadn't really been kind of considered before, and that they had a responsibility to reduce those over time.
And so why has the Trump administration sort of targeted this particular finding in its policies?
Well, this is really sort of considered the key finding that underpins kind of this vast, what has grown to be this vast network of regulations, climate regulations in the U.S. It most directly impacts the car rules just because of how the Clean Air Act has formed. And so this is the one rule that sort of directly underpins the endangerment findings. So they needed to rescind it if they actually wanted to roll back the car rules. But it sort of lays the groundwork and it shows the administration's hand and how they're also going to be looking at other rollbacks. They've already announced some of these. So climate rules for power plants. That proposal is underway, but it hasn't been finalized. Repealing the endangerment finding doesn't now discredit those rules. They still have to go through the normal rulemaking process. But the agency has explained their reasoning. They know that this move will be challenged in court. They have made a case of why they think the Clean Air Act says they do not need to mandate or bring down climate emissions, and they will use some of these same arguments in their future rulemakings for other rollbacks.
And my follow-up to you is just sort of, Zara, like, how can you just, because I want to just get into what was the original finding sort of based on, and how can the Trump administration just go and just say, you know what, this no longer is valid?
Yeah, I mean, the original finding is based on extensive science, you know, showing this is the science that we have seen the IPCC talk about, international scientists, US scientists, that show that the climate is warming, that humans are playing a role in that, and that the impacts are hurting us in various ways. It is important to note that in the proposal for rescinding the endangerment finding, the EPA said that they were going to challenge the underlying science. In fact, they directly cite this report that the Energy Department under Trump had kind of created with the help of five outside scientists, sort of in secret, and was published that same day. And it was a report that doesn't say climate change isn't real, but it downplays the impacts. And so in this proposal, they're saying this is evidence, you know, maybe we move too quickly. Maybe we were wrong. We need to reassess this. But there was a huge blowback to that report, including from scientists whose own work was cited in it, saying this report misrepresents our findings. There was a lawsuit, sort of came out that they violated administrative law and how they put together this report. And so in the final rule, they actually take out this report. And they are not actually challenging the underlying endangerment finding. They are not saying that climate change doesn't pose a human health. They are simply making the legal argument that they do not think it's their responsibility.
Right. Congress could do something as opposed to the EPA, I suppose, would be the other way to address this, saying that basically this is the wrong mechanism to underpin the regulations that are in place. Do I have that right, Zara?
That's exactly right. It's something that they've said. You know, they're saying the EPA went around Congress. This is Congress's job. But that sort of discredits the fact that the Supreme Court looked at this.
Right. That's a 2007 ruling from the Supreme Court, I think, involving the state of Massachusetts. So let me back up a little bit now. So we know there's going to be a lot of legal challenges and there's a lot of unknowns. But if this indeed moves forward, and the endangerment finding is thrown out, and then these other regulations fall like dominoes behind it. The big question I have is, well, what will industry do in response? Like, as a car company, I mean, do I have an incentive now to create a truck or an SUV that emits a lot of carbon? If I'm building a power plant or rehabbing a power plant, am I going to like transition back to coal just because I can? Or there are other incentives acting against those things? I know that's a big question, Zara, but let's try to start breaking that down.
Okay, I think there's sort of two pieces of it.
Sure.
The first is the legal challenges, and they started today. Right. So today, the EPA officially published their rule in the Federal Register, and that is the point at which people can then challenge the decision. It means it's official. And so a coalition of more than 12 environmental groups did officially file a petition in courts today challenging the ruling. So what's expected to be a long legal battle has officially begun. And it is unclear where that will end. It could quite possibly end back in the Supreme Court. Some will say that may be the ultimate goal of this administration, to basically get the Supreme Court to relitigate that 2007 Mass versus EPA decision. But in the meantime, things are very much up in the air. As we've seen just with a lot of court rulings, they could stay it,
right?
Which means that they don't officially take effect. They could not. That's very confusing
for a manufacturer.
For a Totally. And also, you know, a car company isn't going, they can't actually change anything in their cars that are about to hit the lot.
Sure.
Next
they're already done.
Or next month or next year, right? Like they have a long planning cycle. And so it's really how could they weave this into the new cars in a couple of years from now? And there are a lot of things they have to consider, including what's happening on the global stage.
Right.
Where in China, they're moving ahead with electric vehicles in these cars that do not have the same footprint, right? And so it is not a simple calculus for them of what they're going to do.
Yeah. And so this, it seems like right now that even though these changes are take immediate effect, the rule came out today, it sounds like everybody is sort of in a pause state until there's some type of final ruling. Is that correct, Zahra?
Yeah, I mean, from the administration's perspective, this is the final ruling, but it's obviously not the end because it's going to end up in courts and what ultimately happens there is unknown. I will say there is a huge range within industry of what this means, and also different segments of the industry are responding differently. If you're a car company, for example, and you produce a lot of electric vehicles, you have made that a key part of your products, then this may be a bad ruling for you, right? Because it sort of disincentivizes electric vehicles. Trump explicitly said this in his press conference. He's done a number of things where he has come out against electric vehicles. But if you're a car company that has been slow to implement changes and to kind of transition your line, this may be something you welcome because it gives you a little more time to make those changes if you ultimately want to.
That is Zahra Hirji, a Bloomberg climate reporter. Really good setup for us the rest of the hour. Thank you so much, Zahra, for your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you.
And coming up after a short break, we'll bring in two environmental law experts and get their takes on how this deregulation will impact our health and the economy. Keep those calls and comments coming. 888-477-9499.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. This hour, we're talking about the Trump administration's decision to rescind a major climate ruling. It's called the endangerment finding, and it allowed the federal government to regulate and put limits on greenhouse gas emissions coming from vehicles and power plants. We have two environmental law experts joining us now to dig into the rollback, the immediate and long-term impact, and some of the potential legal challenges that are likely to arise. Ann Carlson is the Shapiro Professor of Environmental Law at UCLA and a former President Biden appointee. Ann, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks. Good to be here.
We also have Jeff Holmstead, a partner at the Bracewell Law Firm and former senior EPA official in the George W. Bush administration. Jeff, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yes. And for you, our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere, our question of the day for you is this: what's your reaction to President Trump's push for climate deregulation? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, leave your comment in the chat. And I guess I wanted to start this conversation by just getting each of your reactions to the Trump administration's decision to repeal this endangerment finding. And Ann, we'll start with you.
Great, thanks. Well, my reaction is that this is the latest blow to all things climate. The Trump administration, since the moment the president took office, has been basically dismantling every policy that works to reduce greenhouse gases, starting with major rollbacks of tax credit and incentive provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act, rules that I helped adopt, which are called CAFE rules for fuel economy, power plant rules that Zahra already mentioned. But this is really a fundamental attack against the most important regulatory power the federal government has under the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gases. The one other reaction I'll say, and then I'm very anxious to hear from Jeff, is that I think this is an invitation to the United States Supreme Court to overturn its decision in Massachusetts versus EPA, again, that Zara mentioned, the decision in 2007 that directed the Environmental Protection Agency to consider whether greenhouse gases, which are pollutants under the act, according to the Supreme Court, endanger public health and welfare. The endangerment finding proposal or rule that just came out basically says we don't agree with Supreme Court.
Real quick, before we get to you, Jeff, Anne, I just want to clarify on this whole idea that there's a strategy to get all this back to the U.S. Supreme Court. 2007 is not that long ago. Mm-hmm. It's just the idea that the ideological makeup of the court has changed so much in the last 20 years that they would come to an exact opposite ruling just two decades later. Do you think that's the legal strategy here?
That's what I think. So the court has changed in composition very dramatically. Mm-hmm. None of the justices who ruled in favor of Massachusetts in that case remain on the court. Three justices on the court were dissenters. That's Justice Roberts, Thomas, and Alito. Other members of the court who have joined since then are quite conservative. In addition, the court has issued several cases that cast real doubt on how expansively EPA can regulate under the Clean Air Act, can regulate greenhouse gases. So the administration is basically taking those cases combined with the change in composition of the court and rolling the dice to see if the court would take up the challenge to the endangerment finding and overturn Massachusetts versus EPA.
Yeah, thank you for that. And so, Jeff, I want to get your reaction to the revocation of this endangerment finding and your perceived impact.
So I've been in this business a long time, and I actually don't think, at least so far, the endangerment finding has really accomplished very much. If you look at the rules that have been issued by EPA, and it's partly because of the political system that we have, the Obama administration issued very aggressive rules, Trump 1 overturned them, we had then the Biden administration rules now being overturned. But in terms of the actual impact on greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S., so far, it's had very little impact over the last 16 years. And I think it's certainly not the right way to go about reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We need to have some sort of bipartisan legislation that will actually give people some certainty, because industry doesn't like the swings back and forth. There were very few, if any, industry groups that were calling for the endangerment finding to be overturned. The automakers said that they would prefer to have, you know, reasonable regulations and some certainty. Even the oil trade association said the same thing. So I think the idea that this is somehow the holy grail that's going to solve the climate change problem is a pretty dramatic overstatement.
Let me ask you a follow-up on that then, Jeff, because you mentioned, right, it wasn't like the auto industry was jumping up and down when this came out, saying, yay, we're finally free. So then why is the Trump administration doing it? I mean, there's a lot of people, mostly on the left, saying this is to serve special interests. Do you think it's just purely political optics? We're against green, we're against climate. Like, they have no intent here to actually change the industry or even the regulatory landscape?
So I think ideologically, there are many people in the Trump administration who believe that that Massachusetts versus EPA was incorrect. And they believe that EPA should not be in the business of regulating greenhouse gas emissions without explicit authorization from Congress. So again, this was not pushed by industry. But I think they're, again, ideological. I don't mean to make that sound necessarily disparaging, but
sure.
People who have, you know, their beliefs about the way government should work, and they think that EPA's regulations have been really a regulatory overreach.
And I'd love to give your thoughts on why do you think, I mean, there's this whole strategy that you just laid out as far as like the Trump administration wanting to get this very conservative court to weigh in on this. But why do you think if the industry is not sort of pushing for deregulation, what's sort of, in your mind, the underpinning for moving this forward?
It's a really good question. I don't have great insight into the minds of those who are pushing for the repeal of the endangerment finding. I do know that the folks who are surrounding the president now are more ideological than in Trump one, more conservative, and maybe less willing to listen to industry. I know I've seen Jeff quoted, for example, saying, industry doesn't want the endangerment finding, something he just said to you. So I don't have a great answer to that. I do think that there is a strategy to assault climate from every direction. We're seeing, wholesale attacks on renewable energy, wind energy, solar energy, even at a time when we need more clean energy and we need more energy sources because of the rise of AI. We're seeing the United States decide that we're going to let China lead the green revolution and the clean tech revolution. We're just going to back out of that game. We're going to reduce. We're basically going to go all in on fossil fuels. But I don't have a great answer to your question about why they're doing this, even in the face of skepticism from industry groups.
Ross from South Philly has an idea, says it's all about profit. Thurston kind of agrees and says, who cares about how much money we can save if it requires sacrificing the well-being of our children and grandchildren? But Better Integra on YouTube says the private market is what transitioned to electric. And I'm looking at a nice little graph here, looking at energy generation in the US over time. Wind and solar now outranks coal. Natural gas is still easily the leader, but wind and solar, approaching nuclear now. And I think one of the big questions here, if indeed these regulations go away and the things like the tax credits go away and never return, sort of the incentives and the disincentives, right? And what actually happens to energy generation and transportation in this country? Does it keep going in the same direction it was going because that's the path industry is going down anyways, and they've made these investments? Or is there actually the potential of a real hard U-turn here, whether it's back to coal or back to the biggest gas-guzzling emitting SUV you can imagine? What's your take on your general take on that, Anne?
So I don't think we're going back, but I think we're slowing down.
Got
Uh,
it.
and let me just push back a little bit on the idea that renewable generation is the result of the private market. The private market has had a lot of signals from state, what are called renewable portfolio standards and so forth, tax credits that Congress passed that have really pushed in the direction of renewable energy. Same thing with electric vehicles. I know Jeff thinks that the Clean Air Act hasn't had much to do with shifts in the market, but in California, for example, 25% of new vehicle sales are electric vehicles. That's the direct result of California regulating under the Clean Air Act because of the endangerment finding. We're seeing that in a lot of other states as well.
But it could
I
be
don't think we're going back
right that
because
it's
we're
a ball that this was a ball rolling downhill that the government pushed, but that it's going to keep on rolling downhill. You're saying no, the ball's not going to roll as fast. I just want you to lay out that case a little bit
Yeah, I
more.
think not as fast. And so let me tell you for a couple of reasons, although I don't think that's true with renewable energy, that is what powers our electricity grid, because it's just clear that solar and wind are cheaper. Offshore wind is going to have trouble because the president has been attacking it in all sorts of ways, although he's been losing in court in doing that. But if globally, the market is moving to green energy and to electric vehicles. I was just in Shanghai. It is astonishing to see the number of electric vehicles that are very inexpensive and very high quality on the road. There are more than 100 electric vehicle manufacturers now in China. Canada is starting to let those vehicles come in. Europe has already let some of those vehicles in. Latin America and Mexico are letting those vehicles in. That means that it is going to be harder for our domestic auto industry to compete because there are no longer the kinds of subsidies that the Inflation Reduction Act was providing for battery manufacturing in the United States and so forth. I still think the big three are going to invest in electric vehicles because I do think it's the technology of the future. But they're going to have a hard time competing when China is so far ahead and we are basically yanking any support out from under them.
Yeah, I want to remind our listeners, our question of the day is, what's your reaction to President Trump's push for climate deregulation? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you can drop a comment in the chat. And so, Jeff, I wanted to sort of get your take on this, and Anne, you as well. Anne sort of mentioned that states like California have used this very endangerment finding to sort of help them do regulation. What levers will states still have now that this finding has been revoked? What levers do state have to sort of, I mean, put some regulations in place to control climate change? Can they still have regulations? Can they still push companies to deal with these greenhouse gas emissions?
So that, as you can imagine, that's sort of a complicated question. And for many sources of greenhouse gases that we refer to as stationary sources or industrial sources, they do continue to have authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions at the state level. I think there's a difference of opinion as to whether they can do that for automobiles. I think the Clean Air Act, even without CO2 regulation, probably preempts them from doing that. So I think states can regulate industrial sources.
Like power plants and things like that.
Like power plants and other times. But I think states will not be able to have their own regulations for new vehicles.
Yeah. And your take, how much power will states have? And I mean, and I wonder if these companies, because they're going to have to deal with, you know, 50 different states, different territories, and then other countries, whether or not these companies sort of decide to sort of, you know, regulate themselves in some ways.
So I you may have heard a little hesitation in Jeff's voice when he said states probably don't have the authority. That's because I think if you repeal the endangerment finding and that endangerment finding repeal is upheld and there is no longer federal regulation of greenhouse gases from cars and trucks, there is a good legal argument that states can step in and are not preempted. It's not a slam dunk. I'm with Jeff, but I think probably leaning more on the side that states can regulate, but it will be fought out in court if states go ahead. I don't think you're going to see 50 states moving ahead with auto regulations. There's not a big enough market in Delaware or Wyoming for states to issue their own standards. I do think that you could see California step in and maybe a coalition of states actually have a uniform set of regulations that are stronger. That's actually the way we've operated for many, many years, because California does have its own authority under the Clean Air Act to issue its own standards as long as they're stronger than the federal government's, and other states can join those standards. The repeal of the endangerment finding just upends all of that. It's one of the reasons I think the auto industry is not on board with it, because this basically makes the whole landscape very uncertain. Let me just say one other thing, though. States do have other tools. So Governor Newsom in California has just said that he's setting aside $200 million for tax credits to incentivize the purchase of electric vehicles. States can invest in electric vehicle infrastructure, charging infrastructure, which is a big issue. People aren't going to buy cars if they don't think they can charge them easily, as opposed to going to a gas station. They can get their governments to purchase electric vehicles in fleets and all sorts of things. And I think we're seeing states do that, trying to step in to fill the void. But it's nowhere near as effective as having the federal government be a leader, as it should be, in regulating greenhouse gases from all sectors, given that climate change really is the greatest existential challenge that we face environmentally, despite what the president says.
Haven't heard from a caller yet, so let's bring in Ed in Abington, who is on the line. Hey, Ed, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, just my comment is that I am simply amazed that half of our populace can vote, you know, knowing that this was going to happen, right? You know, like, there's only so much we can do as individuals, you know, buying electric vehicles, outfitting our houses, you know, heat pumps, that type of thing. But, like, you want to vote into office things to make happen in a larger manner, right? And the fact, and what I'm confused about is they don't, whether people don't believe the science or just don't care. And both are, you know, pretty bad. Yeah. I just wanted to get that comment in. Thank you so much for bringing this important to the. Thank you.
Yeah. Ed from Abington. Yeah.
So look, we have to contextualize this in what you were talking about earlier, Anne, which is other moves by the Trump administration on this topic. So withdrawing from the Paris Agreement, got a lot of headlines, of course. We're talking about the endangerment finding, getting rid of tax credits. You mentioned that earlier. When you look at all of that holistically, Jeff, because I know you're skeptical about the impact of the endangerment finding itself, but when you look at it all holistically, both in terms of what it does sort of mechanically, but also in terms of the signal it sends to the rest of the world. Do you think there's a real impact there? Or, as we mentioned earlier, we're kind of going down this renewable path anyways, and what the United States does or doesn't do in a single administration is only going to have a marginal impact. Would love for you to break that down, Jeff.
Yeah, I think you said it very well at the end of your question. I think there are many forces in play that are pushing industry and consumers towards lower carbon energy sources. And I think these actions by the Trump administrations probably do slow that down, but I think the ball is rolling downhill. I mean, there was an analysis from a pretty well-regarded group that did that basically said, you know, with or without this, the emissions are going to continue to drop pretty significantly in the U.S., but they do predict that there would be more reductions if these policies were left in place. And I think Ann and I would probably agree that in terms of actual impacts, the elimination of the tax credits was a bigger deal than eliminating EPA's regulations. As I said before, even if EPA has the authority under the Clean Air Act, it's just not been a very effective way of doing it. On the other hand, the tax credits that were provided under the Inflation Reduction Act, I think made a meaningful difference in terms of the investment.
And on that point, Jeff, I want to read this quote from a former EPA official, Margot Obey, to Inside Climate News. The country, talking about the U.S., is going to be an island of obsolete technologies while everyone else is moving toward electrification. Do you think the U.S. is at risk of being left behind here, or will industry adapt whether or not the government is pushing them in that direction because they'll see the writing on the wall, hey, we have to keep pace with China? And another way of asking that is, can industry here keep pace with countries like China without help from the government?
There's an awful lot to unpack there. I think industry responds to incentives and regulations by governments. And there's, I think, a great deal of debate about how important that is in terms of technological innovation. I'm not overly concerned that the U.S. won't be able to compete on the global stage, but it is certainly interesting that at least at this point, from what I understand, and Ann would probably know better, the Chinese manufacturers are able to produce electric cars much more cheaply than American manufacturers can. And, you know, that's for a variety of reasons. But you know, we have that issue that they have some advantages on cost that our companies already have to deal with. And I don't think even the sort of the tax subsidies that were enough to overcome those.
Yeah. Let me bring in another caller. We have Ray from Port Richmond on the line. Ray, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi there. I was listening to the last caller who was talking about, you know, is it that people don't understand or don't care about the climate science enough to make different decisions? And I really think that aside from this being a climate crisis, I think it's a cultural crisis because when I think about how America and American families think about themselves, we think in one generation. We are built on the understanding that the nuclear family is the ultimate building block of American society. And because of that, we're trained to only think about the impact of things for the 80 plus years that we're on the planet. Mm. But when you look at other cultures, especially some Asian cultures, mm-hmm. where there is much more of a practice of having multiple generations in the home, where you've got children, parents, and grandchildren all under one roof, you're automatically thinking about the past, present, and future in a more expansive way because you have multiple generations under the roof. So I just really think until Americans can start thinking beyond their single generation, we're going to really struggle to have people understand that they can make a significant change in the way climate justice is being approached.
Mm. Yeah, thank you. That's
that
Ray
could be a whole other show.
Port Richmond, I like that. I want to read another comment. Heidi says the cancer rates, particularly lung cancer, are going to shoot up. I never smoked a cigarette in my life, don't drink, and yet I got lung cancer. My doctors told me there had been a huge spike in lung cancer from non-smokers attributed to environmental toxins. i.e. air pollution. And so this sort of raises my next line of questions for you, Ann and Jeff, because in a lot of ways, the EPA provided a shield to companies who were in compliance, especially when it came to environmental issues. And so I wonder, when you sort of do the rollback, you sort of do the deregulation, I'm thinking lawyers could possibly then step in and say and start suing folks to the extent they roll back some of the protections and some of the air quality issues. Any thoughts on that, Anne? Could the deregulation open companies up to more lawsuits when it comes to environmental pollutants and other things? Anne?
So it's probably worth distinguishing between air pollution and climate change.
Yeah.
There are a series of lawsuits that have been filed by municipalities and by some states seeking to hold big oil companies liable for damages that are already occurring as a result of climate change and will occur over the course of the next several decades. So, for example, sea level rise, cities that are going to experience flooding. We already see some of that in Florida, for example. And the repeal of the endangerment finding may open the oil companies up for more liability. This is a really complicated area. There's another Supreme Court case that basically says, under federal nuisance law, which is something that judges can decide, you can't sue because the Clean Air Act is regulating, for example, power plants and other sources of greenhouse gases. If the endangerment finding is gone, that may weaken that argument. It's complicated because these cases are filed in state court under state law, but oil companies have been saying, you're preempted. You shouldn't be able to do this because of the Clean Air Act. If the endangerment finding is gone, that's no longer a good defense for them. But on the air pollution side,
yeah, can we just nail that down? Because we're getting a lot of comments, sure. People thinking, I think what they're imagining is that the Clean Air Act is going away. It's not. This is an endangerment finding under the auspices of the Clean Air Act. So if you're thinking about like 1960s mm-hmm. Pittsburgh, like that type right. of air quality is not coming back, right? I just want to make sure we understand that. We probably should have done that before the end of the hour.
This is about greenhouse gases. It's not about conventional air pollution.
Right.
Although that's also complicated, but for the most part, we're really talking about the emissions that cause climate change, not the emissions that cause conventional pollution that you see that dirties the skies.
Yeah.
Jeff, you wanted to add something there.
Yeah, as someone who used to be the head of the air pollution control program at EPA, air quality in the United States is better now than it has been as long as we've been measuring it. The advances that we've made have really been nothing short of remarkable, and those are not going away. And in terms of the impact on human health, really all pollutants have the emissions have decreased very significantly, except for greenhouse gases.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And greenhouse gases are just much harder to control because with other pollutants, you can use technology to basically capture the pollutants. And that's so far not been really possible with CO2.
Could I just add one thing, though? Climate change is making two types of conventional air pollution worse. One is ozone pollution. It gets worse when it gets hotter. And the other is particulate matter, particularly fine particulate matter that can burrow deeply into your lungs. And because of wildfires that are increasing, we know because of higher temperatures and all sorts of drought, increased drought and so forth, we are seeing huge increases in PM2.5, that's the particulate matter, across the country, including in the Northeast, where we've never seen the kinds of wildfires that we're seeing. We see smoke blowing in from Canada. Of course, my own city of Los Angeles experienced the worst wildfires in our history. Many people lost their lives. Many more people lost houses. And as a result of those wildfires, we're seeing some real declines in air quality, again, of conventional pollution. So there is a relationship between attacking climate change and attacking air pollution. And if we get out of the business of attacking climate change, those air pollutants are going to increase over time. Yeah.
As we get ready to wrap up, Jeff, I wanted to ask you more generally about the regulatory environment, because I think it was a couple years ago now, the U.S. Supreme Court made a decision that affected what was known as the Chevron ruling, which was, I believe, from the 1980s. And this was, we were told, going to have a big impact on whether or not executive branch agencies like the EPA could make and enforce rules. Is the regulatory state, do you think there's been really significant changes in the regulatory state here in America, both environment and otherwise, that are going to have a huge impact? Or would you also say that those impacts might be muted by the actions of industry or the disincentives of industry?
So the case that you refer to hasn't really had much impact yet. I think the theory that people have is that it will constrain agencies like EPA from expanding the authority they have. I do think there's a series of cases, and that one is just one of them, where the Supreme Court has been skeptical of claims by agencies of sort of broad new authorities that they didn't previously exercise. So I think the regulatory climate has certainly changed in that regard, but we haven't seen anything like a wholesale elimination of regulations, or certainly in the Biden administration, there was no lack of regulatory activity. So there's something to the argument, but I think, again, it's a little bit overblown.
Okay, well, we'll stay tuned on that, and we'll thank both of you for your time today. You just heard there from Jeff Holmstead, who's a partner at the Bracewell Law Firm and a former senior EPA official in the George W. Bush administration. Jeff, thanks for your time today on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And also thank you, Ann Carlson, environmental law professor at UCLA, who served in the Biden administration. I want to thank you so much for your time today, Ann.
Sure. Appreciate it. And great to be here.
Yes. And thank you, of course, to our callers from today and all the folks who wrote in and watched us on YouTube and Facebook. And of course, we couldn't do any of this without our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gray.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. We'll talk to you tomorrow.